All right, here we are, Lawyer Talk Podcast, off the record, on the air. We are back. We're doing a special segment, a special episode. But before we get to that, you can check us out at lawyertalkpodcast.com or on all the socials, YouTube by the same name, Facebook by the same name. You get the story. We do lots of stuff for those who have followed the Q&A series. That's question and answer. We do a series with two law students. One here is Troy with me. And then we do a DUI 360 and some breakdown stuff. This is more of a breakdown thing. It's sort of a cool case. Troy, you've been following it. And Troy asked me a question earlier today. We weren't recording. We weren't planning on recording. We were upstairs working where we have a real job with real law stuff going on in the area of criminal defense. And Troy comes to me with a question about this case in Florida. And the there's a couple co-defendants. The first one is, well, the caption is State of Ohio versus
State of Florida.
State of Florida. That's right. State of Florida versus Mario Fernandez Saldana. And by the way, Paul Scarsella with us. He's a lawyer in my office, or he shares office space with us and has a, we'll get to your bio here in a second, but he's got some unique insight. I think it's going to be interesting. And then Mario Fernandez Saldana is the boyfriend to
Shannon Gardner.
Shayna Gardner.
Yeah.
Shayna Gardner. And then we have another man who becomes very relevant here. And his name is Tenon, Mr. Tenon. So here's basically what's going on. Actually, before we go there, Paul, introduce yourself, man.
Hi, Paul Scarsella. I was a prosecutor for 20 years before doing defense work, rent space from you upstairs. I was trying to work on a couple of things, and you asked if I wanted to come down and talk about this case, and it sounded like one that I had done, so I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we hijacked Paul, and there's a reason for that. So Paul was an assistant Ohio attorney general.
Yeah, I spent 10 years with the AG's office doing murder cases all around the state of Ohio.
So you basically were the guy that came in, you were the hatchet guy.
When there was a difficult case in a smaller county or some other larger county and they needed a little help, it was my job to go in and try the murder case.
Yeah, so Paul started his life as a prosecutor. I started my life as a criminal defense lawyer, but you're a defense lawyer now.
I am, yes. Right.
But in fact, we met working on cases together.
I like to say we grew up together. I was a young prosecutor, you were a young defense attorney, and we kind of grew up in Franklin County together.
Right. So we had mutual respect, and here we are at the roundtable. Anyway, Troy, you better cover the facts. So Troy's a law student. One of the things they do to you in law school is they make you stand up and say, what are the facts?
Yes, and I wish we had Becky here. She's more the expert on here. So my understanding of what's been going on is this is the ex-wife of Shannon's, the ex-wife of the victim, and she wanted to have this magical love story with her new boyfriend, who is then hires a hitman to then kill her ex-husband.
All right, so at the risk of not embarrassing Troy here, I'm just going to state the facts.
Okay, cool.
So we got a woman who's married to a dead guy now dead guy, her husband, and woman finds a boyfriend, and they fall in love. And they have this magical relationship, and they decide all we need in the world is for my husband. She decides that is for my husband to be dead. Then we can go pursue this love affair and get married and live happily ever after. That's basically it.
Yes, that's it.
So enter Mr. Tenon, Henry Arthur Tenon, who allegedly is a hitman. And I guess there are places in the world where you can hire hitmen, Florida being one of them.
Mm-hmm. Great market for it there, I heard.
Apparently so. So they... You know, most of these stories, Paul, I mean, we'll get to your experience, but most of the time you hear these stories on TV or otherwise, it's all nonsense. The hitman is usually a cop.
That is correct.
And so, I would say 99 out of 100 times somebody tries to hire a hitman, they end up with a cop or a snitch.
Oh. Well, do the cops actually do the killing?
No, they get arrested for conspiracy to commit murder. So the boyfriend or husband ends up living 9 times out of 10.
Oh.
Yeah. So usually these plots are foiled before they ever get any legs. But not this one. Apparently, Mr. Tenon successfully guns down the husband.
Good Yelp review. That's how they found him, you know.
That's how right. So gunned down the husband. Now, what's interesting about this is Tenon goes into court, cuts a deal with the prosecutor. This is where Paul's going to come in a second. And admits to doing this, admits that boyfriend and wife hired him to do this. And pleads guilty to it and he got 15 years?
15 to life.
15 to life, which would be a decent sentence for such conduct, right? I mean, you might even expect life without parole.
Yeah, so having had a couple of these through the years, I did have a case in southeastern Ohio where a husband wanted to kill his wife, so he hired a couple different dopers from the county, and somebody did, in fact, go in and strangle her. What's funny is he had divorced her twice before, didn't want to divorce her a third time, so he just decided to have her killed.
That's how miserable divorce court is.
He was in his 70s. She was in his 70s. And the actual person who strangled the woman got the best deal out of all of them. So that's generally sometimes how it works.
So how does the guy do it? Like, I already know this, but we're going to let you explain. Like, how does the guy who does the actual strangling get the best deal?
Because what we end up wanting as a prosecutor is the people who actually caused this, right? So in this case, down in Jackson County, the guy who did the strangling had some drug addiction issues and a few things like that. We knew he did it. He is doing life in prison, but he pled to murder rather than aggravated murder, so he's eligible for parole at an earlier time.
Yeah.
But what we wanted was the husband. He's the reason that all of this started. You know, the guy who did the strangling wasn't going to kill this woman, but for the money that was offered by the husband. So in order to get to him, we kind of needed that testimony. So
he cuts a deal.
We cut a deal, 15 to life rather than life without parole, much like probably happened in this case.
Yeah, so just like this case, Tenen probably is caught because you don't really gun down somebody in public. I don't know the facts of the actual murder, but most people get caught. And he cuts a deal and is going to provide testimony against the other two, sort of the how this thing shakes out. And by the way, murder, having defended them, and Paul, you prosecuting them.
And defended them.
And defending, lots of them actually, probably more than I by far. You have, in Ohio, it would be, the minimum would be 15 to life. If you used a gun and they wanted to throw that on, it would be 18 to life. And then it goes up from there. You've got 20, 25, 30, and then life without parole.
Right.
So they're different degrees. So this guy cut a deal that's actually a pretty decent deal for a, I mean, I guess as killings go, we should probably talk about that because not all murders are...
Not all murders are the same. So the first thing you have to understand is what is actually going on behind the scenes. Why was the murder being committed? So in Ohio, and I think Florida's pretty similar, there's an aggravated murder statute, which is prior calculation and design or premeditation is what everybody thinks about it. That's what everybody kind of thinks of as first degree murder. There's some planning that goes into it. So that's what a murder for hire is going to get you. It's going to be an aggravated murder charge because there's the prior calculation and design. There's all that planning that goes into it. We punish that more severely than just, say, a one-punch fight outside of a bar where the guy ends up falling and banging his head and ends up dying from the injuries. That's just a straight murder. It's a purposeful killing. And then there's a couple different ways that you can get around that, too. But for the most part, a murder without any prior calculation and design is 15 to life, no gun. That's the sentence. The aggravated murder in Ohio, and I believe Florida, like I said, is very, very similar. You get 20, 25, 30, or life without parole. And theoretically in Ohio, we still do have a death penalty, but it's just never used anymore. So it still hangs out there.
Does Florida's got a death penalty?
Florida does have the death penalty, and I think they still have the express lane to use it.
Yeah, so they have, this could have been a death case. This is the kind of case that would get death. And it very well may be a death case for the husband or the wife and the boyfriend.
They very well may be facing a death penalty based upon the prior calculation and the premeditation.
So basically the idea, I mean, like, do you remember your definition of murder?
Yes. I'll
feed it to you. Taking one human life by another without mitigation, justification, or excuse. That's sort of the common law definition. And then there were things in common law. And by common law, I mean going back to like medieval times with Henry II and even before that, you would have things that made it worse. One would be careful planning or lying in wait. So like the insurance guy killing, like hiding in the bushes and jumping out and killing somebody. That evidences somebody's intent to really, really, really do it on purpose, as opposed to we just get in a fight or I come home and you're in bed with my wife. That's sort of a hot blood type killing. Those are treated differently. So as Paul said, the circumstances behind it matter.
It's kind of crazy you forgot his name because he's Luigi and this is Mario. It's like perfect.
That is. Yeah, exactly. So we have Luigi and Mario and both were committed similar or at least severe murder crimes.
Charged with homicides, yeah.
Kind of a crazy coincidence this year.
All right, so here's where things get, and I understand this case is in a hearing right now on these issues, but here's where things get sort of interesting. Mr. Tenen, last year sometime, goes in and pleads guilty and cuts his deal with the prosecutors, and I'm sure the prosecutor said, look, we're only going to put you in jail for 15 to life, meaning you might get a chance to get out of prison at some point. For reasons that we don't really know, and I don't think the general public knows yet, there's a hearing on January 13. And on January 13, the judge calls the case. Mr. Tenen is there. The prosecutor is there for the state of Ohio. And Mr. Tenen's lawyer there, Chitfield, whatever his name was. We better get it right. See if we actually have the transcript. Chipperfield is Tenen's lawyer. So the dialogue reads something like this. Before the court, and this is sort of important to know. When we go to court for somebody and you're my client, the judge is going to address me as your lawyer first. We're not going to get this situation where, unless it's predetermined for some reason that might be a good one, that they're actually going to talk to the client, or a judge will actually talk to the client or the defendant directly. Typically, it'd be like, Mr. Scarcella, on behalf of your client, what say you? Right. Well, that's what the judge tries to do. What happens is Mr. Tenen jumps in and says, I just want to bring your attention that my testimony, the court says, no, Mr. Tenen. Talk to your lawyer. No. I just want to bring to your attention false testimony. So the dialogue reads look something like this. The court, talk to Mr. Chipperfield first. Tell him what you want to tell me, okay? Mr. Tenen doesn't talk to his lawyer. Instead, he just blurts out, I want to bring to your attention that my testimony, the court cuts him off and says, no. Mr. Tenen then finishes false testimony. So there's something, when we get these transcripts, it didn't catch it all. And if you were there, there's probably more of this that you would have been able to discern. The court then says, hold on, Mr. Tenen, and then Chipperfield jumps in. Mr. Tenen, we need to talk about that. Mr. Tenen, of course, says he needs another lawyer. They then take a break. They never get back on the record. And they pass on it, meaning in their terms, they continue or postpone the case, which is now set sometime in April. So what we have is this weird hearing where it seems like Tenen is about to say that I gave false testimony. Now, Paul, if you're the, what's great about this, you got experience on both sides. So you're the defense lawyer. What's the first thing you do?
As a defense lawyer, the first thing I'm going to do is scurry my client out of the courtroom and out of the record so that he and I can have a conversation about what's really going on and whether or not there's a reason to go back and try and renegotiate the deal. Because one of the concerns as a defense counsel for Mr. Tenen would be if he goes backward on that deal, because the plea bargaining is based on contract law, the state can revoke that plea bargain. So instead of the 15 to life that he's doing, he could now be back to looking at life without parole, death penalty, or whatever he was initially charged with. So the first thing I would want to do as a defense attorney would be to find out what's going on. Why does he want to revoke his deal? What has happened in the last year since I've seen him? Preferably, as a defense attorney, I would have had this conversation before we walked into court and been able to address it long before it kind of blew up like this.
And it sort of seems like that might have happened here because you see this, Mr. Tenen, we need to talk about that. That sort of implies there's been some discussion.
And you know as well as I do, Steve, that if you're in the back in a holding cell, which is how these things kind of happen, you have your conversations with the clients if they're in jail, you go see them, you talk to them, and then the day of the hearing, they're in a holding cell off to the side of the courtroom. You go back and talk to him. If he's wound up, if he's agitated, you're going to do what you can do to make sure that you don't end up on the record and have that situation happen. Because yep. The last thing you want to do is put your client in more jeopardy. It's not that we want to hide him or do anything like that. We just don't want him jacking himself up because he's wound up on something.
Which makes this more interesting, I guess, because there is not a world where I would have gone to the judge. If I know this is going to happen, I'd go to the judge and I'd say, look, I'm out. Like, I'm not involved in this mess. I've given my advice. Something happened here because in order to get a guy out on the record in front of a judge, usually the lawyer has to be involved in that on some level, or the client is just saying, or the defendant is just saying, I don't give a F what you're saying. I got something to say.
Right.
So you bring him out and then this sort of blows up. So who knows exactly how they got out there, but I think it's, you know, in the point of what we're doing here is that you and I, and hopefully you one day soon, Troy, Paul and I deal with this every day, like the real world dynamics of this situation. And I understand there's a lot of people following this case. They don't get that this doesn't happen in a vacuum. Tenen is sitting in a jail cell somewhere, maybe prison, maybe local jail if he still has to testify. And they got to get him back to the court holding cell where there can be an actual hearing. And presumably it's in person. It doesn't appear to be by Zoom. So he's there. Something happened to get him there. And this, in like Paul, if I'm the defense lawyer, I'm all over this crap because this has the real world risk of blowing up the deal. Meaning you and I say, Paul's the prosecutor. I'm representing you, Troy. Paul and I cut a deal. And the deal is Troy gets, it's a drug case, say, and you're going to snitch against your supplier. And as a result of your snitching, you don't have to go, or you have to go to prison, but only for 1 year. Everybody else is getting 10 because it's a kilo of cocaine.
And I get stitches too.
Stitches, right. Mm-hmm. So, right. So
you're going to get nice yellow pants at the jail instead of the orange ones.
Right, exactly.
Cool.
So then, but part of your deal is you have to cooperate and come back and testify against Rico, your supplier. Now, in the meantime, you have a change of heart, maybe because you have too many stitches while you're sitting in jail or prison because you've already cut your deal. And when it's time for you to come back and testify, you have a sudden change of memory and or interest in providing testimony. Paul's the prosecutor. I'm your defense lawyer. What we have negotiated is basically a contract, not unlike a contract to buy a car. You do this for me, I'll do that for you, and then you, on behalf, or I'm negotiating on your behalf, my client gets a deal. Now you don't follow through on your end. Paul, what happens?
You revoke the deal. It's pretty simple.
You had this come up in a case.
I've had it come up a couple times. One of the cases I did with the Ohio Attorney General's office was the Ohio Craigslist killings, where there were two guys who had an ad up on Craigslist and would bring the people into Ohio and then kill them and steal all of their stuff.
So the people following this Florida case might also be the folks who would be interested. That's a fascinating case.
It's a very entertaining case. Brogan Rafferty was a juvenile associated with a guy by the name of Richard Beasley. They were in Akron. Beasley was wanted in Texas, murdered a man, stole his identity, and then they murdered three other individuals. Rafferty was arrested as a juvenile. He was only 17 when these incidents happened, and cut a deal where he was going to plead guilty to one count of murder and was going to be sentenced to 15 to life. Shortly thereafter, he decided he did not want to testify and was not going to agree to the terms and conditions of the plea agreement that had been made prior to our involvement. So we ended up trying him and convicting him, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The legislature changed that, and he's going to be eligible for parole here in about 15 years. But
did you guys get any whiff of why he decided he was going to change his mind?
He never really – we have our theories, but he never really said why. We think that he just decided that he wasn't going to cooperate, and if he was going to go to prison, he was going to go in as someone who wasn't cooperating. And it's kind of worked out because last time I checked, he had worked his way up pretty high in the Aryan Brotherhood. So probably good that he wasn't a snitch.
Gotcha.
So it worked out good for him.
Right. So the point is this happens, and Troy breached his bargain. You didn't pay for the car.
No.
Or flipping it the other way. You didn't deliver the car that you agreed to deliver. And, you lost your deal, so all bets are off. You come back, and this happens. I mean, I've had this, and I've also had it happen the other way, where the prosecutor changes his mind, where I have a deal with a prosecutor, and then the prosecutor came back when we were expecting to enter the plea and says, the victim's had a change of mind. I can't offer that deal anymore, and that turned into a big hoopla about whether that was a breach of a contract that I could get the judge to enforce.
That's protected under, like, is that Marcy's Law? Is that right?
This predates that.
Yeah.
But it's still what Troy's talking about is a constitutional amendment that provides rights to alleged victims of crime.
In Ohio.
And most states have something similar, or at least a statutory law. So anyway, we digress. Now, if you're the defense lawyer, not for Mr. Tenen, but rather for Mr. Fernandez Saldana, now what?
I'd be kicking and screaming if this is all I had. I just want to know more. I just want to understand why I haven't got more information. That's about it.
So what's going on today, literally today, is there's a hearing on the defense attorney's motion, on Saldana's motion to compel discovery. And again, that's just sort of a fancy lawyer way of saying this. The prosecutor in the case submitted or gave the defense a copy of this transcript. And nothing else. And, you know, as a matter of background, prosecutors have to give the defense this kind of stuff. It's not only a statement of a co-defendant, but it's also helpful. It's called exculpatory. It means it helps the defense. But all they get is this, like, false testimony statement. So, Paul, if you're representing this guy, now what?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is try and send somebody in to see him, but he's represented. So I can't send an investigator in to talk to him because he's represented.
He's got an attorney. So we can't talk to other clients.
Yeah. So yeah. I can reach out to his attorney, and his attorney may tell me, have a nice day, and I'm not going to let him talk to you. So now I'm stuck. But somebody has to know. Specifically, more likely than not, the prosecutor is going to want to know or has to know what this guy's talking about. There's just no way. This doesn't just blow up. There was a letter sent from the prison. There was jail calls. There's something going on that the prosecutor has to be aware of if they're doing their job properly.
Yeah, this is back to when I was sort of surmising there had to been some backstory that got this guy into the courthouse.
Exactly. So there's something that brings him back, unless they were getting ready for trial and they had him back. But the judge wouldn't have brought him into the courtroom if he was just there to testify. So there was something that was going on, whether it was a motion to terminate his counsel, motion to revoke the plea. Something brought him back to the county to have him on the record for this false testimony stuff to even come up. So the prosecutor has to be aware of some little hiccup in his or her case. I mean, there's just, if your whole case relies on this guy's testimony as the hitman, you're going to keep a real close eye on him and you're going to keep a real close contact with him, whether he stays at a local jail or a jail similarly situated so that you don't have to go too far, or if he's in prison. You're going to be visiting with him. You're going to make sure your investigators are keeping an eye on him to make sure that he's still on the same team, if that makes sense. So the fact that all of this blew up, my gut tells me the prosecutors were aware of something brewing.
So then what?
So now if they're aware that this guy's saying that he didn't get paid, this, that, or the other, all of that becomes exculpatory, and you have to turn that over to the defense.
Yeah.
Turning over a 4-page transcript of him going false testimony, well, nice. You know that there's more to the story than just that.
Yeah, and so what happens is the defense does just that. They file a motion requesting specific discovery. In Ohio, we'd call that a motion to compel, or you would say a motion for Brady material, Brady being Brady versus Maryland, which is the seminal U.S. Supreme Court case that says the prosecutor has to give us the stuff that's helpful to the defense. And the defense outlines everything we just talked about. And they demand any communication, any additional information, whatever the prosecutor may have about Mr. Tenen's change of heart. And there's a hearing on it right now as we speak.
Yeah.
So
I'll give it a watch. Don't worry.
I'll give it a watch. Let us know. But I think it's important. So people watch this kind of stuff and they don't know the backstory of how it all fits together. There's just sort of this sensationalized hearing going on in court. I wouldn't say this is a normal situation, but it's not necessarily abnormal. What may be abnormal is that the defense doesn't already have whatever they're asking for. In my humble opinion, if the prosecutor has anything, even if it's their own notes, even if it's their own observations, even if it's a phone call they had with this guy's lawyer or the accused or the or Tenen himself, I believe the prosecutor has a duty, even if it's just a conversation with the defense, to say, "Hey, look, here's what's going on. Here's the backstory. There's a guy that has previously basically skewered your client and put the murder on your client. He's now changing his mind." I mean, if that's not exculpatory, I don't know what is.
But I think if you, for the people watching this podcast and who pay attention to these kinds of cases, just do a quick search for cases dismissed for discovery violations, or, you know, for the state not turning over evidence or the police not turning over evidence. I mean,
yep.
There's a couple, like, right off the top of my head. I'm getting older, so the names kind of escape me. But there were, within the last year, I can think of 3 or 4, like, real high-profile cases, both political cases, non-political cases, all around the country where cases were dismissed because the prosecution or the police, I mean, Alec Baldwin, I think, had his case dismissed.
Yeah.
Because the police did not turn over evidence. So
while
I think this was rare when you and I started doing this 20-some years ago, I don't think it's as rare as it used to be. I think the way that the criminal justice system has changed, the way that politics have entered into it on both sides of the aisle, I'm not picking one side or the other, but on both sides of the aisle, has made it much more about winning than it is about what it was supposed to be about, I think, when you and I started. So I think if you look at this, this probably isn't as rare or as uncommon as people might think. I think it is becoming more and more common on a regular basis. You and I talk about this regularly, whether it's body cam that we're not being given because there's so much of it, prosecutors who aren't properly trained, who don't know these things. I mean, a week doesn't go by that you and I sitting upstairs don't have a conversation about why are they doing this? Why aren't we getting that? You know, this is becoming more and more common. So while it's sensational because it's a murder case and it's a hitman and everything else.
It's got neat. It's got sexy facts.
It's got all kinds of sexy facts. But the real root issue is what's going on in the criminal justice system that these kinds of things are happening on a more routine basis. And I think that should probably concern more people than just whether or not this happened in a murder case in Florida.
I used to say all the time, and I've tried many big cases as you have, Paul, every time I try a case, I find something that I should have had, mm-hmm. that, meaning something in discovery that the prosecutor was obligated by law to give me prior to trial and did not. And it's not always something that's a smoking gun, helpful bit of information, but almost always I find something and you would have to ask why. And it's, I can't attribute that always to bad intent by prosecutors. I can't not always attribute it to bad intent by prosecutors. I think it's a combination of a couple of things, and Paul, I'll hear your thoughts on it. But I think, one, we have poor training in prosecutors' offices often, where prosecutors are trained by the prosecutor who trained them, by training them, who trained them. And I don't think there's always a clear understanding of what it means to be helpful to the defense. And what I mean by that is I have heard prosecutors say, well, yeah, we knew about that, but we didn't think it would help you. And my response is, you thought enough to consider whether it would help me, and isn't it my choice as on the defense to decide if it's helpful? So they just are acting under this hat of misinformation. And then I think you have egos. I think you have, like you said, Paul, people just want to win. And, you know, this is a clashing of ideas. And anybody who's been in a dogfight of a trial, you know, we can be friends outside court having beers, but you get in the courtroom and all of a sudden it's like game on. And it's hard not to take that personally even as a professional with experience. You want to win. And I think prosecutors want to win. They want the conviction. They got the victims. They feel bad for people. They want to win. And then somewhere in the mix of all this, you have the bench. You have the judges who, I believe, some do a great job policing this kind of stuff. Some not so great. And it's an endemic problem that has not been solved. And there was an effort to solve it. We talked about Brady versus Maryland. And that was a case where the U.S. Supreme Court basically establishes that the government has a duty to turn over the helpful evidence. And then cases have sort of emerged about the consequences. And one consequence would be the least drastic measure would be, all right, the defense gets a continuance if they discover this before trial. If they discover it during trial, that continuance doesn't work. I mean, you're already in trial. Sometimes you get a mistrial. And maybe they can't retry the case. Sometimes it gets so bad that the judge dismisses it or doesn't let the state use the evidence. So there's different remedies, but it really, like anything else, I think until there are drastic measures taken by a trial judge, the problem's going to repeat. But the trial judges don't want to take those measures because then they risk a guy like Tennant going free or Gonzalez or Saldana.
Yeah, in my head, there's just risk-reward. We're already pretty far out from the trial. It's not going to delay it too much more. And what, we're going to make this the staple case of punishing prosecutors? We let potentially two alleged murderers go over it?
Well, and we don't know. We don't know if the prosecutor intentionally did something wrong here. We don't know all the facts. So we're sort of talking somewhat esoterically. But behind all this is the specter that there's more to it.
Yeah.
And the defense doesn't know it, and they had to file a motion to get it. Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it comes down to the simple idea from having been a prosecutor for the majority of my career. One of the things that I always was afraid of was waking up 10 years down the road and realizing I had put somebody in prison who didn't belong there. That was a legitimate concern of mine. So I spent most of my time making sure that the cops did their job right, that we got the right guy, that if I was going to go to trial on a homicide case, and for the last 10 years at the AG's office, that's pretty much all I did. I had the ability and the luxury of working a limited number of cases, not like a whole docket in a county that most county prosecutors are dealing with. So I had the ability to put that time into those cases. Having also worked as an assistant in a large county like Franklin County here in Columbus, you know, the docket gets crazy. You know, you have on any given day 80, 90, 100 cases on your docket. Some of them you know from looking at are going to be a real quick plea because it's a low-level offense of theft or something along those lines. And the murder cases are a little bit more serious, but you've got so many other things on your docket, you only have so much time. So when you talked about training, I think part of it is also a resource issue. I don't think prosecutors' offices get the resources that they need, both from a training standpoint as well as from the standpoint of allowing the assistant prosecutors in that office the time and effort to fully work their cases up. I also don't think that the culture in a lot of prosecutors' offices allows for that. It's highly important that a prosecutor's office understand that their job is to see that justice is done, not to get a conviction. And I'm not sure that that happens a lot in most kind of prosecutor's offices. So I think it's a resource issue. I think it's a culture issue. I think it also has to do with a training issue. And then sometimes I just think it's a docket issue. There's just too many cases. And people are willing to kind of resolve it for a low-level offense just to get it off the docket rather than doing what they should do, which is dismiss or something along those lines. So this ability about discovery and just the technology has changed everything between phone records, between body camera footage. There's just, you and I started, Steve, a murder case might be three witness statements and maybe a fingerprint if we were lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah.
Okay. So it was all about the people. So it was witness statements. So you would just go out and talk to them. Now it's phone records and ballistics and DNA.
Geofencing.
And geofencing and warrants. Yeah. And, you know, just the time it takes to get through a homicide file these days is immensely larger than it was 20 years ago or so when we started. So
yeah, it's a chore.
All of these things come together and they don't make these issues less likely. They unfortunately probably make them more likely.
Yeah, the more work, the less time, and the less time, the less you can attend to these details. But, well, look, we're going to keep following this case. Now I'm sort of interested. But, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing in this case, and people are interested in it, but it's also the kind of stuff we see in all sorts of cases. So the idea here is to break it down, give you guys the legal ease part of it, but also break down and make it simple. Because as I love to say, I like to make things simple, and almost everything can be made simple. Mm-hmm. This is there's something going on here. The defense wants to hear more about it. The key witness in the case seems to be pissing backwards, and I guess time will tell what that actually means as part of the case.
We'll get Becky in here too. She's pretty much the expert on this. Like if you saw everything she has, it's amazing. So she knows everything on here.
So Becky, we want to talk about the case with you or answer any questions that you may have. So that was probably more than anybody wanted on it, but you got it anyway. So this is Lawyer Talk breaking down the Fernandez-Saldana case. And we will do more of this, I promise, off the record, on the air, until now.